Welcome to the Agents of Cool. Join us tonight as we join Jim Phelps on a mission in the 60s and a strangely familiar mission in the 80s. Jim Phelps versus Deja Vu. Welcome back to the Agents of Cool. Tonight we're going to be talking about some Mission Impossible. We're going to be comparing a 60s Mission Impossible to a little seen 80s Mission Impossible. But before we get to the meat of the show, there's been some news and stuff going on in spy media this week that I feel like we should address for the show. Notably, award-winning, highly artistic director Danny Boyle has quit the next James Bond movie over quote-unquote creative differences. Which in this case seems to be actual straight-up legit creative differences. Now, Danny Boyle is a guy that directed...
Not the creative accounting used to determine his final paycheck?
I don't think so, no.
That's normally what they mean when they say creative differences.
That's normally what... Well, not this time. Now, this was... His hiring for the next Bond film, presumably Daniel Craig's fifth and last, which would also be the 25th Bond film, was highly touted a few months ago. He's considered something of a get. This is a guy that did the movie where James Franco cuts his arm off, the one where Ewan McGregor's on heroin. He did the one that was...
All activities I associate with James Bond, yes.
Well, certainly, yeah. Danny Boyle, highly challenging artistic director, who actually worked with Daniel Craig on the intro video for the London Olympics.
X number of years ago,
which is how we got into this whole orbit. And he had his own idea for a film. He brought in his writer, brought in his team. They were all very excited about developing Bond 25, and then this week we're all kaput. I gotta admit, I'm somewhat bummed by this because he's a great director. And what he might do with the kind of resources and the muscle of this big old franchise movie, maybe Bond movies are the ultimate franchise movie. It was exciting to think what somebody of his ability could do with something of that scale, but apparently it's not to be. Now, what I've read is that the whole thing came to a head over an actor that Boyle wanted to cast as the villain, like this out-of-left-field Polish guy. I can't remember the guy's name. You can look it up if you're interested. But he wanted to cast this guy as the villain, and basically it was him and Daniel. Like Daniel Craig was like saying, no, I don't want this guy. Daniel Craig has got probably more influence over his run of Bond films than the previous actors had over their run of Bond films.
Yeah, well, because I know the Kobe Rocker was like, oh, well, that's nice, Sean. Bye.
Yeah, and then Connery hated Cubby to the day Cubby died.
Pretty much, yes. Well, I mean, I guess we'll find out in 10 years when somebody publishes their memoirs.
And we'll have dueling stories. And when that happens, we'll cover it right here. So I'm a little bummed, and they don't have anybody to direct Bond 25, and they've got the whole distribution deal and the release dates lined up, and now they don't have a movie. They were going to start shooting. We're recording this towards the end of August in 2018, and they were going to be filming in January 2019 from where we're sitting right now. And all of a sudden, they don't have a movie anymore. Because when Boyle leaves, his script goes with him, his team goes with him, the whole thing's out the window.
And they can't use any of the ideas he came up with unless they want to cut him a check, and I'm sure that's going to be a whole, oh my lord.
And of course, if you use his script after he's gone, then now you're hiring somebody, some hired gun to come in and shoot Danny Boyle's script, and you know, and they've been in prep, and they've been doing, at this point, they've probably been doing storyboards and planning stunt sequences, and now you pretty much got to shut the whole thing down.
I think Eon Productions rule number one is, have the rights to the script in perpetuity for all time.
They're not going to do it because Danny Boyle's gone, and it's just going to be embarrassing to have some hired gun come in and do his script. Now, Barbara, if you're listening to this, I'm available. I've got a vision, my rates are affordable, and I'll let Dan Craig do pretty much whatever he wants. We'll get along fine. Our email is going to be at the end of the show. Just fast forward ahead if you want, and just give me a call and we can talk about it. My agent, her name's Mary. She's a tough negotiator, but it'll work out just fine. Now, also, we've all seen Mission Impossible Fallout. Mm-hmm. You've probably listened to our microdot by now. I wanted to alert our audience, if you aren't already aware of this, there's an English film magazine called Empire. Empire has something called, creatively, the Empire Podcast. Christopher McQuarrie, the writer-director of Rogue Nation and Fallout, does podcasts for Empire that literally run longer than, and I'm not exaggerating, this is not hyperbole, runs longer than the films. He did a podcast for Rogue Nation that ran significantly over 2 hours, and we're looking at well over 4.5 hours of content for Fallout.
This is 4.5 hours edited?
Four and a half hours of Christian McQuarrie edited talking about Fallout.
So there was more than 4.5 hours to begin with.
Yes. Now, you know, here's what it is. I'm working on through these podcasts now, and I strongly recommend them for their insight into the filmmaking process in general and for their insight into these films in particular. I don't know. Is it okay to plug another podcast? Do we do that thing?
Sure, why not? If somebody plugs our podcast, I'm not going to complain. Certainly.
So if you aren't aware of these, go look up the Empire podcast, because Christopher McQuarrie is highly erudite. He's highly intelligent. He gives really thoughtful and considered answers on almost everything. And it's an invaluable insight into these films that we enjoy and into the filmmaking process.
Do they actually talk about the hanging off of very high objects writer in Tom Cruise's contract?
I haven't listened to all of it yet.
Because I'm curious how that works.
I will tell you this. I listened to an earlier one where McQuarrie shows Cruise a picture of something, and he did not say what. Shows him a picture of something, and Cruise says, and I quote, "Man, I'm already looking forward to hanging off that." Or something like that.
See,
I'm probably butchering
the quote,
but there it is.
I knew there's a writer in there somewhere, and essentially his salary is in dollars and feet above sea level.
Exactly.
I'm just going to... That's my theory here.
Now, I haven't heard anything that contradicts that. So there we are. Now, as we record this, we should observe that today is the birthday of Sir Sean Connery, noted star of Zardoz and
League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, Medicine Man.
Outland.
And was there something else he did? He did some little indie.
Outland.
Outland. He did some little indie movie.
Oh, he was in a spy movie, Avengers.
Wasn't he in?
Yes.
Oh, that was the one with Ralph Fiennes.
Yeah.
He was in Ralph Fiennes. He was in Medicine Man. He was in The Presidio. What else did he do? He was in The Rock, which was actually, you know what, that which actually reminds me of that other part he played for a little while back in the 60s.
Hunt for Red October.
Hunt for Red October. And he was in those little indie spy movies back in the 60s.
That British outfit?
Dr. Yes.
Something like that.
From Boise with Love?
No.
From Boise with Love?
No.
Coldfinger?
No.
What?
It's Dr. No.
Dr. No. Oh, that's it. Those are kind of, we do the obscurities here, but even those are pretty obscure even for us. But happy birthday, Sir Sean Connery. Shall we sing? We going to sing?
I don't want to sing.
Happy birthday, Sir Sean. Okay, we're not singing. We're not going to do that on this show.
We are not a singing people.
And lastly, with your permission, I would like to plug a book. Can I plug a book?
You can plug a book, sure.
I've actually finished writing.
Is it a spy book?
It's a spy book. I've actually finished writing. Remember the podcast we tried a few years back that I couldn't quite get it together on? A few years ago.
Agents of
Dancer.
Cool?
Dancer.
Oh, the podcast?
Radio? Yeah.
Oh,
Dancer.
That's not a podcast. That's a radio theater production.
We did a radio theater production a few years back about it was kind of a Victorian spy
a few
show.
Years back.
It's been a while now.
It's been a long while.
Well, I like that idea. I went and turned it into a novella.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah. And I'm editing it, and I'm going to like proofread it and upload it to Kindle and get like.
Oh, okay.
Get it on Amazon for people to read, and I just wanted to alert our readership, our listenership, all five of them, in case they wanted to buy it.
Okay.
So Leighton and Gina and Andy, if you're still listening, I hope you are. I'm gonna have a book out at some point. It's kind of like a cross between the English Avengers. It's a little bit steampunk and it's a little bit Wild Wild West, and it's kind of steampunky. And if you listen to this show, I think it'll be up your alley. And I'll let you know when it's ready and uploaded, and you guys can all go to Amazon and buy it.
Our initial foray into radio theater, which went nowhere, is the reason I have a mixer.
The reason we have these microphones.
Mixer, microphones, pop filters, other bibs and bobs in the basement. So you said, I want to do a podcast. I'm like, well, lo and behold.
Here we are. So what it was we were inspired, or I was inspired by the great and mighty Greg Taylor. He of Toronto, Canada, Lord and Impresario of Dakota Ring Theater, the immortal Red Panda himself. And the story what I was attempting was beyond my ability as a writer at the time. I do have a novel worked out, and I think it's pretty good, and it'll be available at some point. And I'm invoking the Dread Lord Taylor. I'm invoking the Dread Lord Greg Taylor, because we love him, and we will obey him in all things, of course. Wouldn't we? If Greg Taylor told you to go march on, you know, Boise, would you march on Boise?
If he did it in the Red Panda voice, yeah.
Well, obviously.
If he did it in the Sabian voice, I'd like, sure, absolutely, Detective Sabian, and then try to figure out how to weasel out of it.
If Clarissa told you to march on Boise, would you do it?
I'd be afraid of being beaten up.
Yeah, but I don't want to get a concussion.
So, yeah, also, by the way, if you're listening to this and you aren't listening to the Red Panda Adventures, Dakota Ring Theater, go listen to Dakota Ring Theater, all of it. You should listen to all of it, every last word, because it's genius. And Greg, should this somehow reach your ears someday, we're here in Kentucky now, and we love you. We love you, and there's no other way to put it. So come down here sometime. We'll have dinner for you. I'll get my daughter to make you a cobbler. It'll be great.
If we're doing plugs...
You're just looking at me like I'm crazy.
No.
Okay. And I might be. It's fine. I'm just making the observation.
If we're doing plugs for favorite audio groups, and I love them...
Well, let's do that.
Also, don't forget, you know, apropos of nothing, since we're... So I was going to be at Dragon Con in, oh my God, less than 4 days, attending, not actually on a panel or anything. But, you know, the Atlanta Radio Theater Company, which was my first exposure to radio theater and have, you know, just was absolutely captivated by them the very first time I heard them.
Dead I listen now. To podcasts about murder, which really isn't on theme, so I'm just going to...
Well, I don't know. Aren't spy stories all about murder?
No, these are mostly unsolved murders, and these are more... These are more Bulgarians dying badly in bathroom type murders. Is that fair?
Wow.
Well, Bulgarians dying badly in bathrooms does happen in spy stories as well.
Oh, yeah, we're still in. Yeah, I'm still not hearing anything contradictory here.
Yes, my favorite line from a recent one was, "Now the most important thing about 1970 is that's when I started my serious murders."
Like he was just practicing up to then, finding his stretching his wings a little bit. He didn't do his really serious work until the 70s.
Yep.
Oh wow. I do like that he has a work ethic. He feels like he's got a standard he has to live up to.
Yeah.
Isn't it worth doing anything well if you're going to do it?
I'm not really a fan of the Murder and Mayhem podcast genre as a general rule.
Or the Murder and Mayhem TV genre, sadly. I can never get him to watch this stuff with me.
Well, you and my sister-in-law, do you watch like the forensic stuff on like the news channels on the weekends? Like prison shows and unsolved murders and things like that? Do you watch like 48 Hours and those
drive? Oh, when I can, yeah.
All right, so tonight we are actually here to talk some more about Mission Impossible. Specifically, we've talked a little bit about the fact that there was a brief two-season revival of Mission Impossible in the 1980s. This is an interesting story. I've got in front of me now the complete Mission Impossible dossier by Patrick J. White, which I strongly recommend for any... It's not in print anymore, but you can pick this up on eBay, Amazon, used bookstores and whatnot, and I strongly recommend you do because it is just jam-packed with... everything you could possibly want behind the scenes and trivia and information and everything. Now, what happened was in the mid-80s, around 87 or 88 or so, there was a writer's strike. Now, you may remember like a couple of sucky episodes of The Next Generation that we got because of this writer's strike.
A goodly bit of season two of The Next Generation.
Goodly bit of season two.
I think that's, about season two, episode one to season two, episode, oh God, is it over yet?
Yeah. Now, and I'm paraphrasing here, and if I get some of these quotes wrong, I apologize. There's a writer's strike, and nobody's got anything to put on TV in the fall. And some bright boy has the idea, well, why don't we just remake some old scripts? Somebody actually has the idea to remake old shows. We got all this pile of scripts over here, why don't we just shoot some of them again? People who watch TV are basically stupid, right? They'll never notice.
Right, well, no, that's
Let's just
crazy.
Reshoot some things.
Yeah, well, that's insane. Just, like, remake the same movie or TV show later remake and not make a new one?
Remake the exact same show.
No, that's not sustainable economically. The movie-going audiences won't stand for that.
So this was their genius idea. This is literally what they had the idea to do. So someone says, why don't we redo, we've had some success with this Star Trek deal. Why don't we do Mission Impossible? And I'm looking at this thing right now. I'm quoting. It says, and I quote, "To offer viewers as much original programming as possible, ABC Entertainment President Brandon Stoddard announced in July of 88 that the network had signed with Paramount to remake 13 of the best mission scripts as new episodes to be filmed entirely in Australia with an all-new cast for fall 1988. Quoting, "Mission Impossible was and remains a genuine evergreen among television series, with new audiences still drawn to the old shows because of the unique casting and stories. With a new cast and a whole new set of locations to bring added sizzle to the best of the original scripts, we feel Mission Impossible will deliver both originality and vitality to our fall program schedule." Now, not everybody was super thrilled about this.
See, the thing is, I mean, I realized that was meant to be studio exec bullshit, but I'm like, he's not wrong.
He's not wrong. Although I'm pretty sure the use of the word originality in that paragraph is maybe he maybe needs to check his thesaurus.
I'm automatically suspicious if anybody uses the word sizzle non-ironically in a public statement. But on base...
Unless they're making me a mistake.
That's true. But on basis, I really can't disagree if anything said. Mission Impossible is awesome, and we think people want more Mission Impossible. I mean, I think we're evidence that people
want more Mission Impossible.
These people want more Mission Impossible.
Now, here we are 30 years later, and half the people involved in this are all dead now, so this is all kind of water under the bridge, really. Moving on, it says, "Not everyone was thrilled with the news. Quote unquote, I'm furious that my work is about to be used to prolong our strike," said Mission vet William Reed Woodfield. And William Reed Woodfield was one of their stalwart writers, noting, quote unquote, "There's not a damn thing I can do about it. The only consolation is it's going to cost ABC a fortune. Shooting the show here was almost impossible, but shooting it in Australia." Both Woodfield and Lawrence Heath had their names removed from the remade versions of their scripts.
Ah, yes, because the goal here was to knife the Writers Guild, so that's...
To screw the writers.
Here's the twist.
Now, for the record, we have a small altar over here to our left to Harlan Ellison while we're discussing paying the writers. We are invoking the spirit of the dread Lord Ellison here, as we have recently. Anything done to basically shaft the writer, we're going to take pictures of Gene Roddenberry and we're going to burn them over here on this altar to the dread Lord Ellison. But this whole thing was designed to screw over the Writers Guild. But here we are 30 years later, and Mr. Woodfield's dead, and I think all the executives are dead, and poor old Peter Graves, God rest his soul, he's dead. So yeah, we are left with the actual shows. And, you know, the shedding's all over with, and you know, we're left with the show, so what are we going to do? They did end up not remaking 13 scripts. They ended up only remaking 4. And they picked one from season 5 called The Killer, which guest starred Robert Conrad as an assassin who acts randomly, thereby making his actions incredibly hard to get ahead of and anticipate. It was remade as the premiere episode of the 1988 Mission Impossible, filmed in Australia, starred John DeLancey, Q from The Next Generation, and Discord from My Little Pony, which are basically the same character, as an international assassin who chooses his actions randomly, thereby making his actions hard to anticipate.
I assume there's some kind of rule where if you bring back a beloved 60s property, possibly specifically tied to Desilu, that you put John DeLancey as the villain in your first episode.
I'm guessing he probably did it because he got to go to Australia, and why wouldn't you? But there are some significant connections across both these shows. Now, the Mission Impossible from the 60s starred Leonard Nimoy. This is one of the Paris episodes with Leonard Nimoy from Star Trek. You also had William Conrad as the hired killer, Eddie
Robert
Lorca.
Conrad.
What did I say?
William Conrad.
Oh, I'm sorry. I would love to have seen William Conrad. I would love to have seen William Conrad as the international assassin. But no, it was Robert Conrad. You're right. It was Robert Conrad as the assassin, Eddie Lorca.
Also of Wild Wild West.
Also of Wild Wild West. So you see a guy from Wild Wild West on Mission Impossible. This was probably a pretty fun thing if you're watching spy shows back in the 60s. And it's kind of a pretty fun thing now. As an aside, I like that he's named Lorca because, of course, that's the captain played by Jason Isaacs on Star Trek Discovery. So you just got jam-packed. You've got an episode jam-packed with like cool references and actors and things from the 60s. And then from the 80s, you've got John DeLancey as your bad guy. You also have the actress who played Zahn on Farscape.
Virginia Hay.
Virginia Hay, the blue girl, who had just been in The Living Daylights at that point as the mistress of John Rhys-Davies, General Pushkin. And you have, you've also got a show that was directed by Cliff Bole. Or Cliff Bole, I'm not sure how you say the E in the end of his name. I've never heard it said out loud. Cliff Bole or Cliff Bole, I'm not sure.
The
guy the Boleyns were named after, who was also a significant directorial presence on The Next Generation. There's something faded about these shows, I guess, where you have all these Desilu, Star Trek, Mission Impossible, science fiction, spy show interconnections. So we have a show made way back in the 60s, and then you have a show made in the 1980s, and they are, to all intents and purposes, the same story. Now, there are differences. They did take the episode, and for the 1988 series, they updated it with some fresh scenes in the beginning to justify why Jim Phelps is back. Funny thing is, they were literally going to remake the exact same episodes with the exact same characters. But at some point, a decision was made that the new show in the 80s was going to be a sequel instead of a remake. So instead of having Thal Finglas, and I'm sorry, I'm not sure how to pronounce his name. I've never heard anyone say it aloud either. Thal Finglas as Roland Hand, you've got Thal Finglas as Nicholas Black, who instead of being a nightclub performer is a drama teacher. Instead of Cinnamon Carter, you have Casey Randall. Instead of Willie, you have Max Hart. Instead of Barney Collier, you have Grant Collier, Barney Collier's son, played by the son of the actor that played Barney Collier. So it becomes a sequel instead of a remake, but it is still precisely the same story. Oh, even though that it wasn't a Cinnamon Carter slash Roland Hand episode they're remaking in the first place. It's the same story. So in the 1988 version, they have the then-current leader of the IMF killed by the international assassin, which brings Jim Phelps out of retirement to avenge his friend and protege.
Well, that was a question I was wondering. Was it the head of the IMF that was taken out? That's presumably the guy on the making the tapes. Was it an IMF team leader that Jim trained?
It was whoever succeeded Jim.
I mean, I guess we kind of get the idea, I mean, maybe from the movies, but... you know,
that there's more than one team.
There may be more than one impossible mission team out doing impossible missions.
Now, this gets into kind of some speculative territory, because they were very clear in the 60s show, I think, that the Impossible Mission Force was this off-the-books thing run specifically by Jim. They were deniable. It was all off the books, under the table. Which, of course, if we do this now, they would be derided for issues of transparency and illegality. But this was the 60s, and times were different. And then get to the 80s, and there's an implication that there is an agency somewhere that is the IMF, and that there are other teams, and that there's training going on instead of just recruiting likely candidates.
We do. I mean, there's always the question of the binders.
There's always the question of the binders.
There's an impossible mission force in the original
and
one.
And someone who is not Jim Phelps sends him these tapes and works for someone called the Secretary.
Now, fun thing about Mission Impossible is that it does leave room for some headcanon.
Well, this is
now, in my head, it's the Secretary of State. But in your head, the secretary may be somebody very different.
Well, could be the Secretary of Defense. It could be Secretary of Defense,
Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Secretary of Agriculture.
That seems less likely.
Wouldn't have been Homeland Security though, in either the 60s or the 80s.
Actually, there is precedent for hiding your spy agency in the Department of Agriculture.
Sure.
There's a great book that uses the hypothetical Fredonian Department of Agriculture as the cover for its spy agency. It's a great little, it's called the Spy Master's Handbook. It's a great read. But
so it does look like maybe that the IMF has gone from being an off the books Jim Phelps privately run thing to being an actual government deal.
Well, this is the thing though. What is the distinction functionally between a covert government organization that, you know, is just an absolute black project that exists off the books and a conspiracy inside the government with high-level sponsors? I mean, functionally, they're the same thing.
I mean, for purposes of watching our thrilling spy stories, it doesn't matter a whole lot. But maybe it does represent a change in thinking over time.
I mean, there's always been somebody leaving those tapes for Phelps, and before him, Briggs. So...
Well, it wasn't all. Sometimes those tapes were delivered, those messages were delivered in different ways. Mm-hmm. Like Dan Briggs got an actual record album in his first episode. Mm-hmm. Sometimes these tapes were left with pictures.
But they're coming from somewhere.
They're coming from somewhere.
And somebody, and I mean,
so the missions are not being assigned by Jim, but he seems to be the guy that gets to pick the team.
But and sure. Also, I mean,
or a guy that gets to pick the team, if we assume there are multiple people, not just Mr. Phelps, who gets tapes.
But somebody makes arrangements with the courier to leave it there. Somebody, when he interacts with somebody, somebody has made arrangements for the little code phrases that presumably mean it's this is the guy who I've never seen before who's supposed to get this message. And presumably somebody, if they don't give the right code phrase, then they have orders to deal with them or otherwise make sure that message does not fall into the wrong hands.
I would assume just go on fishing or whatever and let the guy go away to steal the...
Right, and not give him the tape. And presumably it's booby-trapped to self-destruct or something. But that's the thing. Somebody had to set that up. Phelps has to know what the challenge and counter-challenge phrases are for that particular day. And so, I mean...
Now, it is true that this in the remake, they do refer a bit more to, you know, Casey Randall was a designer of something, presumably fashion designer, who started working with us and has been doing so ever since. So there is an us.
There's always been an us.
Right.
The Hartford Repertory Company, they got to eat. Okay.
Right.
So when they went off to the People's Republic of Slovakistan to construct a submarine.
Now remember, we decided they weren't constructing a submarine. What they did was take over the People's submarine school.
Then they were staffing that or otherwise doing that. Somebody was paying for them. Somebody made those arrangements. Somebody had vetted out the Hartford Repertory Company as people that aren't going to squeal.
But they weren't actually an actual agency of the IMF per se. Was not an agency.
No, they don't have an HR department, but they have somebody doing these various
tasks. By the time
we
get to 1988, the IMF is actually an agency. It's not something Jim runs out of his apartment anymore. Just the secretary sends something through back channels. It's actually a full-up deal.
It wasn't ever just run out of Jim's apartment. I mean, somebody sent him the tapes. Somebody collected all that information and gave him the digested format.
This is where we disagree.
No, but he's saying the IMF is specifically Jim Phelps and whoever he picks.
Because it's something run by Jim. I assume he inherited from Dan Briggs, although they never address it. Again, we've got room for headcanon here. What I'm maintaining is that it's obviously they're obviously running at somebody's direction. Somebody gives them the missions, but the IMF isn't something with a building, a headquarters in Washington, D.C. It's something deniable. Roland Hand did not work for the government. Roland Hand was a nightclub performer, and once a week, Jim Phelps gave him a call and says, hey, we got this guy in South America we got to overthrow. Cinema Carter did not work for the government. She was a fashion model that got a call once a week. Barney Collier ran his company and presumably ran it into the ground because he spent all his time helping Jim Phelps overthrow banana republics and Eastern Republic dickheads.
I mean, I don't think Casey Randall or Nicholas Black work for the government openly either.
But by the time we get to 1996, Ethan Hunt does work for the government.
Mm. Oh, Hunt absolutely.
They make it explicitly the CIA in the first movie.
Right.
But the IMF is apparently something within the CIA. By the time we get to Mission Impossible 3, the IMF actually has its own building and its own headquarters run by Morpheus.
Which is a bit odd since it's not supposed to be something anyone knows about.
Right.
Well, so I guess the question is, so in the 60s, is the IMF, okay, it's not a formal agency, is it more of a thing you put together when you have an impossible mission? Well, this mission is impossible. We have something for that.
We got
so it's something
we
you
got
basically ad hoc together and say, okay, we need an impossible mission force to tackle this specific assignment. And maybe it's not always necessarily Phelps. It was Briggs at one point. At some point, it was handed off to Phelps. But
is it possible there are multiple teams running at the same time?
Right.
I think by the time you get to 1988, there are.
Well, I think
because it is actually a place, and I assume it's got a building and a headquarters. And
so it doesn't have to have a building if it's still a deniable.
The information funnels through, and the extracts are prepared, and we have a list. in a little Rolodex in a vault written on flash paper, and we have this problem, and whoever makes those tapes flips through that Rolodex and makes contact and says...
This is part of what I think is beautiful about it. You have your headcanon, right, I have my headcanon.
That's the thing. It doesn't really need like a formal, this is the IMF building on the CIA campus.
And again, by the time you get to Mission Impossible 1 and then Mission Impossible 3, there is a formal structure. It is officially straight up a government agency.
Right, but I guess the thing is, when you get to various deniable black op operations, and this is kind of the problem when the Army started dabbling with their defense, defense support activity stuff, their own sort of Army spy agency, and then there was some problems regarding the spending of the money. It's sort of like, well, you can't, if you're a deniable black ops operation, you can't really follow the regular Defense Department record-keeping procedures for money, because the whole point is you're off the books.
Right. We're a line item in the helicopter budget.
Right.
That actually gets diverted over to this.
Right. That's the problem they ran into.
Which actually, that's why the defense budget went so crazy in the 80s, because G.I. Joe was crashing.
That's why hammers cost several hundred dollars. It's because that was skimming off to go to G.I. Joe.
Exactly. They were crashing all those like $100 million jet aircraft. Well, that's why that budget went crazy in the 80s. You watch, it'll come out.
But that's the thing. From a certain point, the CIA has they have a department for doing covert operations. But beyond that, that org structure is pretty much a black flipping box. Now, and they have all sorts of off-the-book assets or ones that are controlled by assets.
And you see, what you're doing here is you're letting like reality bleed into our entertainment.
But that's the thing. The thing we like about Mission Impossible is that slight frisson of plausibility. The ones where we're up against the Eastern Republic's operatives in the Southern Hemisphere, it gives it that frisson of Cold War. I like those episodes a lot more than we're going against a nameless criminal syndicate. The Mafia just doesn't have that frisson that the opposition, an actual full-up nation state has.
For me, the execution of the episode, I mean, I like them both. I'm fine either way. Except for that one where they got to take out Robert Goulet in a Greek restaurant. I felt like that was probably beneath Jim Phelps' attention.
They were punching down on that one.
They're kind of punching down on that.
They were really punching down on that.
Who are we taking out next week? Wallace Shawn? And we're going to take it. This week we're taking out Robert Goulet in a Greek restaurant. Next week we got Wallace Shawn over there running a hot dog stand. We got to take him down.
I guess really it's the same plot. It's the same.
Armand DeSante and a taco. And it's not even that I mind the Robert Goulet thing, actually. He does have a certain charisma. There's that moment where Barney looks at Willie and says, seriously, we've saved the world 100 times and we're going to be shot by some asshole in a Greek restaurant in L.A. It came to this. Yeah. It came to this.
And that's the thing. The stakes, the reason you like them, we like the ones where they go up against other nation states, is the odds are much higher. If you're about to get whacked in a Greek restaurant, it's because below that Greek restaurant is a nuclear bomb. It's
because Jim's kind of phoned it in that week. It's okay. But Barney's like, Jim, maybe some missions you shouldn't accept. It's okay. Some missions maybe you shouldn't accept. But you see, this is where we differ about our interpretation a little bit. You see it differently than I see it, which is one of the things I think is terrific.
It's interesting
about
that some of these things are like extinction level or at least geopolitics altering events, and yet the one guy they know how to call gets to turn down every mission individually.
But he never does. Well, is that something
they presumably have a contingency? It's just a lot. What's the line from the Leonardo DiCaprio movie where about the early years of the CIA? And there's somebody says, "Well, you're the CIA. Those are the guys that start all those wars." He's like, "No, we just keep the wars from getting big."
Ooh. When was Leonardo DiCaprio in a movie about the CIA?
Is it Constant Gardner? Is that one? No,
I can't remember the name. I remember that from the trailer.
Ooh, I'm intrigued.
Anyway, the point is they probably have an option.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
It's just a hell of a lot worse. I mean, the option they are going to release viral hemorrhagic fever in North America. Well, our only credible response we can't stop them is we nuke them.
But before we nuke them, we call Jim. Because Jim has an amazing history of stringing together these actors and this one dude that runs a computer company, and they make stuff happen.
You realize, of course, the guy that runs the computer company and the fashion model, this is like some guy recruiting Bill Gates and Cindy Crawford to run spy missions. You see, I like that. You see, well, here's
because they're always like the biggest of these things too.
There's a fine tradition of that in fiction. Look at Doc Savage. His five associates aren't like, none of them are the second best engineer or
the second best ape-like chemical expert.
Yeah, right. The best. The guy who was third in his class at Harvard Law. Yeah, right.
It turns out the nation's third best chemist actually looks like a hedgehog. And then number four is actually kind of like an armadillo. But we go with number one because he looks like an ape.
That's fair.
But that's the thing. So,
but those five guys don't have to keep it a secret that they work with Doc Savage either.
Well, no, but the point... I mean,
whereas the fashion model who's on magazine covers all the time, and yeah, the 60s equivalent of Bill Gates, who is also a black man, which is probably even more notable, has to keep it a secret that he occasionally pops up all over the place.
But the number of people outside the electronics industry that knew who Hewlett or Packard were...
Well, okay, that's fair.
Were people.
They have pictures up at Micro Center, but other than that...
Right,
yeah.
But well, here's the thing. The reason they have those pictures up at Micro Center is because up until you saw that picture, you didn't know what either of them looked like. Part of that is, okay, look, in our little space, these are the titans, these are the guys, the superstars of this crazy little world we inhabit.
Well, here's the thing. I also think that's, this is why I think it's interesting to compare the 60s and the 80s, because I think you look at the way they treat it in the 60s, there are different ideas there, number one, about how we think about celebrity these days and how we and how people get famous. Like these days, there's a fair chance a guy in the street does know what Bill Gates looks like because he's kind of famous. Barney Collier wouldn't have been famous.
Right.
Mission Impossible as a series also tends to be kind of colorblind. In the real world, a guy that runs a hugely successful electronics company in the 60s, who's also African-American, that guy gets famous. So we've got kind of a different commentary on what it means to be famous and a celebrity between the 60s and the 80s. I also think that you get a certain commentary on patriotism. I think the suggestion in the 80s that these guys work for the government, and by the time you get into the Tom Cruise missions, that these guys are all actively government employees. Rollin is a patriot. Cinnamon's a patriot. Barney, Paris, all these guys, they do this because they feel like this, their country is calling them. They don't get a check from the government for this. They go and do this because it's good work and it needs doing. These later guys are working for a living. But the guys in the 60s, because I think we had a different idea, maybe it's something about patriotism and belief in our country and our values and what we stand for, I think people thought about that differently in the 60s. Than they do later.
That's an odd thing to suddenly have be a thing in the late 60s and early 70s.
Yeah, I don't think that holds water. I mean, the fact that Tom Cruise is a government employee in Mission Impossible is because the idea that somebody's doing the stuff he's doing and gone for days at a time, and that isn't his full-time gig, that has trouble holding water with an audience.
Luther wasn't actually a government agent in the first one, right?
Well, no, he was an agent who got
disavowed.
But the thing is, the fact that they're doing it for gratis versus, okay, this is the full-time gig, any one of them could make a comparable amount of money with far less chance of being shot, stabbed, poisoned, infected with some sort of horrific bioplague, chemically interrogated.
I'm not saying those guys aren't heroes. I'm not saying they're not patriots. Okay, all I'm saying is that I think it represents... I just think it represents a changing of ideas. I think people thought about this in the 60s in one way, and we think about it a different way now.
Really see what Jim Phelps does for a living.
Yeah, he doesn't really have a background occupation. I mean, presumably he has some kind of cover.
They never sketch in what Jim Phelps,
It's entirely possible that Jim's, you know, all the mail that comes to that house is John Drake, and that Jim Phelps is...
an identity that only exists to the IMF.
We don't know who this guy is. He entirely could be...
Jim Phelps could, in fact, be an interchangeable identity.
His job may be being available to put these teams together and run them, and money turns up in the bank account.
Probably he's getting paid by somebody.
And then this is one of the things I like about this show is because it leaves so much unsaid that it allows you some imagination to go in there and think about what some of those details are. It's kind of interactive in a way.
If we assume that guy in 1996 was Jim Phelps, then he had a wife by that point, but she was also in the IMF. So.
Yeah.
Right, well, that's the
I'm not assuming John Voight and Peter Graves are playing the same guy. But you can check our back catalog for my extensively documented opinions about the representation of Jim Phelps in the first Mission Impossible movie. Or just approach me in the street. I'll happily illuminate you about it.
Don't approach me in the street.
Approach me in the street.
Don't make eye contact.
Dare you. I dare you.
But, I mean, part of it... The one thing I kind of liked the cachet about it, before it was the actual honest to God IMF with, like, IM logos and IM stationery. And for all we know, the binder was just a joke. Kind of like their... For the longest time at the Lockheed Skunk Works, there was a coffee mug with the nose of a stealth fighter sticking out behind a cloud the in-house paint shop made for one of the engineers, because, it's a stealth fighter. It's shy, right? Which, unfortunately, it had the shape of the nose of the stealth fighter, which was a super classified plane. So the guy could use the coffee mug, but it had to be locked in the safe in the Lockheed Skunk Works offices. So for all I know, that was just a lark by one of their embossers or document forgery guys.
Yeah.
So, name them the impossible mission.
Right. But the idea that the agents don't necessarily even know exactly who they're working for specifically. Even they're caught, I got approached by this guy and we did the thing, but they don't necessarily know.
Since in theory it's not always the same five people.
Right. But
and occasionally you'll get like an extra bonus guy.
It's
but
just,
not often.
You know, periodically, okay, you get the little coded message and you cancel your gig or whatever, and, or make reasons to be in New York, and then you're drop off the face of the earth with a presumably plausible cover for a few weeks, and then you're back. And that to me was kind of cool, the fact that it's this shouty organization that almost the people working for it aren't entirely clear how far up it goes.
See, and that's beautiful. That's your headcanon. That's your show. I think everybody who watches this show actually comes away with a slightly different show in their head. Because there are things the show leaves unsaid, but, which I think is part of the beauty of it.
Compare it like with like Uncle or some of the others where the cast you have like the big giant S.H.I.E.L.D.-esque spy agency that's got, you know, secret lairs everywhere like Batman and such. That's cool. But the idea of the IMF being sort of this shadowy organization that is nebulous, doesn't really have a headquarters. It really harkens back to the early days of the OSS and such where it was, okay, Bill Donovan, the father of the OSS later, the CIA, we need a spy agency. And I was like, well, who do I know that might be a good spy? And so it was people he knew. There wasn't a paper trail. It was all done handshakes in a back room, and it was all very ad hoc. Again, that's to me that's the part of, you know, Mission Impossible I really like, just harkening back to the, there aren't really, as you say, I guess, formal government employees in terms of drawing a check. It's just these sort of, I guess, talented amateurs, as you were, going off and doing their thing at just with some general direction from the government. And yes, they're completely deniable assets.
All right. I've said what my show is. Ray said what he... What's your show? How do you see it? I see it one way. He sees it one way. How do you see it?
I mean, I think fairly similar
to
Ray's.
Or have you overthought it like we have?
Well, I mean, I think... The thing is, it's... I guess it's...
Like,
I've overthought
it a little bit.
Just in this discussion, I've been trying to figure out, well, what do we know, really? Because we don't know anything about Jim. We know there's somebody above him that gives him missions and information and gathers this initial intelligence.
And presumably is paying the bills.
Or maybe the secretary is Money Penny. Maybe
she's
literally
the secretary.
Literally the secretary. And that's a shout out to Susan if she happens to be listening. So maybe the secretary is actually Money Penny.
You're right. It's very clearly.
Or maybe it's literally a secretary. I don't know.
It's very clearly an arm of the CIA in the movies. That's undisputable.
Oh, yeah.
The question really becomes
until you get to number three,
it's
where it's its own
to the
thing.
CIA.
Well, yeah, that kind of the whole, is it the Army Air Corps? Okay, now it's the Air Force. Okay, now it's back to the Impossible Mission Corps again. It's kind of this, but...
They really shouldn't have a building.
And yet in three, they do. And now we're getting to the part where JJ, and specifically his writers, Mr. Kurtzman and Mr. Orsti, maybe aren't the sharpest crayons in the box.
I mean, okay, the CIA and even the NSA... have buildings.
They do.
And yet we're not supposed to know exactly who works for them, in what capacity, and so forth.
Wait,
like
did
that.
It say but, Impossible Mission on the building, or is it just a building they were using?
Well, I'm not sure what it's, but it's, they have a building.
But did they have like a big IMF logo on the floor or something?
I don't remember that. I haven't looked at that one in a couple
G.I.
of years.
G.I. Joe had a building. It was underneath the Chaplin School in New Jersey.
Well, unless you watch the cartoon, in which case it was apparently a fortress in the American Southwest that was highly public.
Right, but the G.I. Joe that was kind of closer to a secret spy agency Black Ops thing, the fact that it was in the Chaplin's...
The one that's in
the Chaplin School motor pool.
Well, now this is a totally different show. Are the G.I. Joes in the cartoon, the comics, is that the same thing?
No,
are they the same world?
No,
the cartoon. So for you, they're two different worlds.
They're completely two different worlds.
Two different worlds. Okay, then, because in the cartoon, their identities are secret, but their code names are public. The organization's public, and you have the giant fortress in the Southwest. If you read the comics, it's a very much more covert kind of deal.
In the cartoon, Cobra Commander is a complete lunatic. Mm-hmm. In the comics, he is. Possibly one of the most dangerous, yes, but also one of the most dangerous people on the face of God's green earth and treated as such.
Well, yeah, and he should be.
So at some point we're going to talk about these episodes.
But the question though is, so it's not really which, it's not really, I guess, really which it is, because in the movies it's clearly one thing, and in the TV show it's arguable. Which is your preference? Do you have a preference?
I definitely prefer the more shadowy, made up of amateurs aspect, because that makes it different from other things. Where, Eric, do you get the notion that by the 1980s series, they're already working openly for the government?
Well,
or at least working more directly for the
government?
Because
what I've read in the dossier book and what I remember from watching those episodes and the episode we watched today, there are, for me, indications that there is a structure and a bureaucracy that exists outside just what Jim's doing. No, I've read ahead a little bit in the book. Apparently, there's an episode about the guy that was the researcher who developed their mask technology.
Ah.
So now you've got somebody in a lab somewhere actively developing technology that is used by an organization. It's not just Rollin in a back room with some spirit gum and whatnot, right? There is a guy who was hired to develop a thing for an agency. And then again, maybe it's just the impression that I get, which is, I think, also fine. But because, again, I think there's some space here for us to figure out for ourselves what's going on.
I mean, in some versions of Batman's story, they give a name to the guy that designed the Batmobile, but that doesn't mean he exactly knew what he was doing or that there's anyone... other than him and Bruce Wayne that have any idea that he built Batman's car.
If you're building the Batmobile, you know you're building the Batmobile. The check you get doesn't have Wayne Foundation signed by Bruce Wayne on it. Mm. They're probably shell companies at work there.
Right. At some point, we should probably get to comparing these episodes.
So, well, that's the thing. They're kind of the same episode.
But
they have interesting differences.
That's true.
They wear a lot more sweaters in the 80s.
Well, of course, the 80s one, as we said, has to set itself up as the first episode of a new series.
Some of the lines are almost the same, but the settings and such, it's Los Angeles versus London.
The mechanics, the motivations, the way they move through the cities, it's almost exactly the same.
The largest difference between the two was in terms of the openers. In the original one, Robert Conrad is just sort of in a hotel room, and there's some girl dancing to radio music in the background.
She's probably on LSD the way she's dancing, let's be honest.
Or something.
It's a very 60s moment.
And, you know, he gets a phone call, and he comes across more as, okay, this is a fifth season. So he comes across more as a gangster, more as what we think of, you know, as a mob hitman, which, again, it's later run, so they're up against
the syndicate. They actually mention the syndicate by the end. Yeah.
So, you know, he's got a tattoo of some dice on it, and, you know, he's rolling a pair of dice, which...
Conrad comes off as being kind of laid back and lethal.
I didn't think Robert Conrad would get more tanned.
Mm. He got tanned.
He was seriously tanned. I mean, I don't know if he'd just gotten back from a trip to the tropics or something. He is massively tanned in this. This is like George Harrison's going, damn, son.
Dude, dial it back.
Yeah. Okay. So,
did you say George Harrison or George Hamilton?
George Hamilton saying, yeah, do dial it back a touch. So he comes across as a mob hitman. I mean, flip our comrade. So he's somewhat charismatic, but it's also, there's a certain amount of,
he's a bit of a jerk to the girl, but yeah, maybe that's expected in the 60s.
Right.
I'm not sure.
Well, no, but that's the thing. It's basically, he's come across as a high level mob torpedo. I mean, he's wearing the wife beater shirt and the whole. You know, he's so suave international assassin. He is not.
Right.
Okay, he is not Chow Yun-Fat from The Killer. Okay.
Now, John DeLancey, on the other hand,
your open shot of him is him doing a hit, and he's wearing a tuxedo, and it's a party, and there's champagne flutes, and it's all very Bond. Mm-hmm. And less the untouchable. And, you know, John DeLancey plays the character very differently. Of course, different actors, but...
Dickish.
Well, I'm kind of wondering, in the original script, did they have a hit set up and they just weren't able to film it and they needed to fill that bit there with the stuff, with the apartment scene at the beginning?
Well, I'm going to speculate. Hmm. I'm going to speculate that they wanted to show the guy in action because you need to see him kill the person Phelps is going to avenge.
Right. And that's, I guess, the big difference. The hook there is the first one, it's the same summary. You have a killer. He selects his methods at random as close as possible to the time of the hit as possible. So they want to know who's bankrolling him. There's a guy, someone named Scorpio.
In both versions.
In both.
The killer's being, now in the original, his name is Eddie Lorca. In the remake, he goes under a number of aliases, but is currently using the one Matthew Drake.
Right. So.
But both versions are working for a guy named Scorpio, which is the real target. IMF wants to know who Scorpio is.
They want to know who he is. That's why they don't presumably just, because the question is, well, why don't, if they know this guy, this killer does this, why don't they just black bag him and call it a day? Again, getting back to if the IMF knows all the stuff the IMF knows, why do you need to send somebody in if they know, the childhood phobias of every South American dictator?
Yeah.
Okay, but the idea is stop him from making the hit and use him to figure out who the heck Scorpio is. Okay, great. So, they don't know where he's going to stay or anything. They just know he's going to arrive. The gag is they pick him up at the airport and whatever hotel he says that he wants to go to, they have a blank slate hotel ready to go. They will mock it up as whatever hotel he tells the cabbie to take him to, and they're going to take him to this hotel, which they've got wired for sound and everything, and then the idea is they will monitor him that way.
And there's an awesome scene in each version where in either 20 or 25 minutes, depending on which collier is doing it, they have, in the first one, it's definitely a staff of people. In the remake, it's a smaller group. They literally make all of the trappings, all the stuff that you would need to believe that this hotel is this specific hotel.
Yeah, there is a high-tension scene where the sewing machine they're using to embroider the towels jams, and they only have a few minutes to get...
And there's an old lady that's actually working the sewing machine in the original version to embroider the towels. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, something goes wrong with the sewing machine and Jim pistol whips her.
No, listen,
no, that's
Ann
not,
Warren,
I'm sorry, that's not what happens.
It.
That's not what happens. I just made that up.
That one actress, she kept trying not to look at the camera, so I don't know if that was somebody's mom or aunt or, like, the winner of some sort of cereal contest or whatever.
Now, in the original version, you have Paris and Willie in the field mm-hmm. trying to give Barney enough time at the hotel to get the mm-hmm. hotel ready before the killer shows up. In the remake, you have Nicholas Black and Max Hart trying to delay the killer long enough in the field to get Grant the time to get the hotel set up. The lines of dialogue are the same. Some of the camera angles are the same. The scene works very, very well in both versions.
I think it's actually, this is the one thing. So they've got a larger cast. I mean, they sell it as here's a hotel. It kind of reminds you a little bit of the Sting. You know, they come come in and you've got people kind of milling around and starts handing them stuff. And you go into behind the hotel front desk. There's a secret door that goes into their back office operation. And you've got multiple people embossing books and putting the little rate cards and typing up all the hotel stationery.
Yeah, in the 60s, they're all doing this manually.
You've got the people embroidering the towels and the bathrobes and everything
with the name of the hotel that he picked randomly out of a phone book.
Right. So, I mean, it is a major operation. You've got the magazine protectors that the hotel magazines go in. I mean, it's this major operation that's going, go, 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 trying to all this stuff in 20 minutes. Now, again, to our mind, printing off a bunch of documents and such in 20 minutes, no big deal. That's a trip to Kinko's. But boys and girls, there are typewriters involved.
Now, in 1970 and in 1988, that would have been a much more substantial. Chicken feed now, but it would have been a lot harder then.
In the scene in the 80s when they have a laser expert, you wonder, what's the laser expert for? Well, lo and behold.
Laser printing.
Yeah, well, laser etching on the glass and such.
Yeah.
Now, interesting tidbit, actually going back to the opener though.
Yeah.
I realize the apartment scene with the Robert Conrad character is deliberate because there's a couple shots of his bag of different stuff in. He's got a gun and there's like some golf balls, a collapsible golf club and some other stuff. And you know, you see that again and it's essentially the reverse of the IMF briefing scene. You know this guy's a killer.
What is he doing with these
things?
What
are all these things? What is this oddball random collection of things?
The gun makes sense, but why is also the golf balls?
Right. And
that's one of the reasons I really like this particular set of scripts is because it plays with the tropes of the show in interesting ways.
Until I said that, I realized that wasn't just like a filler scene. That was, they're trying to establish the character as kind of a mob torpedo, but also it's the flip of, well, he's got the stuff in his bag. What's he going to use to kill the guy? Because
how are these pieces going to fit together?
Because he chooses randomly every time. So just because he has a gun.
Doesn't mean he's going to necessarily shoot his target. So, they get to the hotel, they get checked in. And I think, honestly, I think the getting to the hotel scene is a lot tenser in the 80s remake.
I agree.
I mean, you've got Max Hart zipping around on motorcycle, and everything is edited a little tighter. And it kind of has to be because you had that opening bit. You have a different opening bit in the 80s one where the victim of the assassin, John DeLancey, just darts him with a hallucinogenic dart and he hallucinates that he's on fire and falls 10 stories to his death. So then you see the funeral and you 50, 60 feet away is Jim Phelps watching. That's about as close as he can probably get because they're not supposed to know each other, presumably. Mm-hmm. And then you see him in a Cliff Huxtable sweater. It was the 80s. Mm-hmm. And he has a little exchange with a fisherman. And it's very similar to the exchange that he had in the first one with a guy fishing where he gets the initial briefing tape.
And the guy just walks off and leaves his tackle box, which turns out to have the...
Right. In the 80s one, though, it's a little bit longer conversation about, you heard about that, that guy for that spy agency that died. Said he's one of his best agents,
best team leader except for the guy who trained him.
And Jim agrees, which is possibly the longest conversation and probably the most heartfelt conversation Jim Phelps has ever had with the contact man in the history of service with the IMF.
Maybe with anybody.
Because remember, Bruce Geller, was basically didn't want them emoting at all, period, full stop. No. You're emoting, whack, whack, whack. So that is positively them exchanging weeping man hugs over the death of a fallen comrade.
Yeah, it's an interesting proposition because in theater, you're kind of expected to produce the great plays again. There have been great versions of Hamlet. As long as people do theater, there will always be great versions of Hamlet. People will do 12 Angry Men. You're going to do Waiting for Godot. You're going to do... People keep coming up with new plays, but in theater, you're also expected to do new versions of old shows. In movies and TV, remakes are kind of looked at kind of side-eye, right? And what they did here in literally remaking a TV show, to my knowledge, has never been done before or since. And then they did it to shaft the writers. But it's fascinating because you get to see in different eras, in different dress, you get to see things executed by different teams on different continents, and it is absolutely fascinating.
I mean, from the same base script.
And that's, you can really see what we think of. It's a slightly shorter runtime because more commercials, but also what our expectation of pacing and cutting is, we want stuff cut together and paced a lot faster. So
like you said, as a result, the scene with the hotel, getting the hotel ready before the guy gets there, is actually tighter and more suspenseful in the second version because it's shorter.
Oh, yeah. The flurry of activity lends to it, but it's basically the various delays and such that they contrive to slow the cab down because the guy wants to get there as fast as possible. Mm-hmm. And, well, they need 20 or 25 minutes. Well, he wants to get there in 15 minutes. And if he doesn't, he's going to just bail on the cabbie. And mm-hmm. at that point, they lose him. He goes to a different hotel and they're SOL because mm-hmm. they only have one. There's only one hotel they have wired up for sound.
It was a Hail Mary that they got him at the airport in the first place. If he picks a cab that doesn't have an IMF driver,
yeah, each time he passes the first IMF.
But they had two, though.
If there's lots of cabs in front of him, if they lose him, if he gets somebody that's not our guys, then you're hosed.
Yeah, but that's
so. It's kind of a long shot in the beginning. Well, it's kind of a long shot to begin with.
Well, they
it's
play
beautiful the way they do.
Well, they play with that because you see, oh, he turns down the first guy, turns down, you know, mm-hmm. and then he goes the second cab, and then you find out, oh, the second cab has another IMF agent in it. Yeah. So mm-hmm. you think, and again, that's kind of that. Oh, they're screwed. Oh, whew, you know, that little bit of suspense until mm-hmm. the camera pans down. You see, oh, you know, there's Paris. There's, you know, in both shows they get them to the hotel. Okay, and then the assassin calls their contact person. And, you know, these are kind of establishing bits. You know, the guys, you know, both assassins are kind of jerks and kind of picky about, you know, well, they want to get there in time or they're going to bail, and that's kind of how they build the suspense there. And, of course, this is on the hotel phone, and the IMF is listening, and they then, in both cases, in both shows, call after they've concluded the negotiations. They're going to meet at a
specific place.
Yes, yeah, specific place. I think it's...
They swap.
Right, but it's like...
One of them is he wants to meet in the hotel room, and they change it to the park, and the other one is he wants to meet somewhere public, and they change it to the hotel.
Right.
In both cases, IMF diverts the contact, so that the contact meets an IMF person, and then an IMF person impersonating the contact meets the killer.
Right. Mm. You know, in both cases, they meet the contact person first.
Therefore, getting the details of the hit.
Get the details on the hit. They look and, oh, it is some sort of U.S. union leader in both cases. Actually, I think it's the same name.
Significantly, it's an African-American union leader in both cases.
Which means that Barney and/or Grant has to be the guy.
So your Collier can be the guy that impersonates him.
So there's a photo or, you know, photo of news article. So they replace the actual target with their respective Collier's picture. Mm-hmm. And then a IMF agent posing as the contact person then meets with the assassin and hands them the information. Now, they don't change any of the information other than the picture. And then they make arrangements with the target to get them out of the way and replace them with their Collier.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So then we get to the assassination attempt. Mm-hmm.
Which is similar in both versions.
Yeah, they've replaced, even though they replace the guy with Barney or Grant, they also replace Barney or Grant with a dummy of Barney or Grant.
And the dummy from the 60s show is spooky. For just a split second, mm-hmm. I thought the way they cut the shot is you think it's Barney and he's dead.
Yeah, and the dummy in the 80s version is not as good.
No,
it's the dummy in the 80s version looks like they just grabbed something from a department store window and spray painted it brown.
Yeah.
It's like, Grant, I know you're supposed to be this like genius son of the great Barney Collier, but for God's sake, try harder. Really, we're the IMF here. We are not some like community theater show.
He graduated MIT. It's not, you know, he didn't graduate the art school, so he wasn't a sculpture major.
Grant, we got standards. All right. We got standards. This is the show. This is the big time.
Does the mannequin say Collier Electronics on the bottom? No, it doesn't.
No,
it wouldn't anyway because this is a deniable asset.
No, it doesn't say Collier Electronics because the Collier Electronics name carries a certain cachet that this mannequin does not live up to. We got standards here, Grant. After this show is over, I imagine Jim taking him aside and giving him a talking to. I'm going to expect a lot more out of you, Grant. We need better.
Do we know
this.
That Grant provided his own dummy?
Given that they didn't know they were going to need a Barney dummy or a Grant mm-hmm. dummy until that exact moment.
And mm-hmm. Barney had a dummy ready that looked just like him at a moment's notice.
That raises some uncomfortable questions. I am not prepared to engage in this podcast.
Yeah, but was Barney ready? When the moment came, was Barney ready for anything? You bet he was. When the moment came, was Grant ready? No, he was not.
It took him 20 minutes to create a hotel from nothing, but a perfect dummy of himself. He's just got there in the room with him.
Barney Collier was the toughest son of a bitch in the 1960s. He got his legs shut off, and he gave him a cocktail waitress and a steak, and he was fine 5 minutes later. Grant Collier can't even put together a perfectly lifelike dummy in 5 minutes. Good God.
Anyway.
I tell you what, MIT's standards must have dropped dramatically from Barney to Grant, is all I got to say.
So anyway, the assassin goes to the hotel. and
does not go in through the lobby.
Right. So in one case, he calls ahead and make pretending to be someone else and see if they can get the gets a specific room one floor above the target. Mm. In the 80s, he sneaks into the hotel and breaks into the room one floor below the target room.
Now, in both cases, turns out those golf balls in his suitcase were plastique.
Yeah, so he crushes them up. He calls to the room and, talking to Barney / Grant, pretends to be a local union representative who would like to meet with him in about 15 minutes, thus ensuring that they're in the general vicinity of where he wants them to be. And so then
the IMF at this point have lost track of the guy and don't know that he's in the hotel because he didn't come in the front.
Yeah, they tried to follow him. They lost him. So they don't know where he is at this point. This whole time's going on. Nobody but the audience knows where the assassin is. And they're trying to, is he going to shoot him? He could shoot him. He could poison gas. He's never used the same method twice. It could be anything. Okay, so that's the problem. They don't know, So, they take some steps like drawing the blinds and such and other, but they literally don't know, is he going to just kick the door in and shoot him in the head? Whatnot.
Which is one of the reasons why I think you would remake this one, because this is a great story.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's
because Jim and the team in both versions have to, swear to God, think on their feet, mm-hmm. rather than having every move planned out from the start, like the chess game, like it usually is. This is Jim having to stay one step ahead.
And it should be noted that in both episodes, while the assassin is waiting in his hotel room, they're watching him on the closed circuit TV cameras they've hidden in his room, gets out his little classical golf putter and practices putting with these three golf balls. So you don't really think there's anything odd about them. So he crushes them up and he gets out a little timer. And in the 60s version, he suspends the timer and blob of plastic off some string and lowers it down the ventilation duct to the one floor down. So it's roughly lined up with the ventilation duct in Barney's room. In the 80s one, he takes out a little circular drywall blade and
cuts out like Bugs Bunny cuts
a hole in the ceiling.
Cuts a hole in the ceiling.
And affixes the plastic to the ceiling above. In both episodes, he's seen to be taking careful measures to not leave any fingerprints, not uses a handkerchief and a pencil to dial the phone, and that sort of thing. So he's, trying not to, leave any trace. And he gets almost the exact same techniques and such in both scripts. So time's counting down, time's counting down, time's counting down. They don't know where he is, they don't know what's going on.
There's a much bigger delay in the 60s version.
A little bit, yeah. I think he calls again to the phone's ringing and ringing and ringing, and Barney's not sure, should he answer it, should he not? Mm-hmm. And then, he's away from it and then decides that, I can't remember why in the 60s when he basically went for the door, vice in the...
In both cases, Jim has a brain flash, basically, and tells him to get out of the room.
Now that's one of the ways I think the 60s version's a little bit superior. The 60s version takes a second to show. There's a shot where you see Jim looking around the room. Shot from Jim's point of view, where he's trying to figure out where the attack might come from. Then, when the clock's ticking with the plastique later, you see Jim go through that thought again, and then he realizes the air vent's the problem.
Versus, I think, in the 80s one, they see him out front.
Mm-hmm. And they realize he wouldn't have left unless the process was already started.
Right, and that point, Jim realizes, wait a minute, he's not going to leave unless he's got everything in place.
So he needs
to get out of there to time now.
And, in both cases, it's Jim intuiting, because he has been able to get into the guy's skin a little bit. It's Jim intuiting, get the hell out of the room before you blow up.
Right, so a couple ammo. And I think the 60s version, they send...
Hold on one second. I can't even... She's so generic compared to Cinnamon, I can't even remember what her code name is, what her actual character's name is.
Casey?
No, in the 60s.
It's Dana.
Dana, yes. I didn't even catch that in the episode.
Leslie Ann Warren as Dana Lambert. We barely even talk about her because as much as Miss Warren is a talented and famous actress, she doesn't make a serious impression as Dana Lambert. I'm sorry. Yeah, we're most of the way through this podcast now, and we haven't even mentioned that there's an actual actress in this show who's not Cinnamon Carter, because she's not willing. Yeah, this is kind of a problem. Vis-a-vis contemporary issues of gender and race, I think the first two or three seasons of Mission stand up very well next to other 60s TV shows. And then now we're getting to a couple later seasons, and there's a woman on this show, and I can barely remember what she did, and I don't even remember her character's name.
There's not a lot for her to do in this one, the comparable character in the 80s one gets to do.
Yeah.
Which we're actually about to get to. Okay, in the 60s version, they send somebody out to say, oh my god, this guy was killed on the fifth floor, and at that point you see the Robert Conrad character depart, because, his mission accomplished, and in the 80s one, he just assumes, well, I'm seeing smoke pouring out of the top floor of the hotel, I'm pretty sure I got my target. In the 60s version, he meets the contact person, who is, at this point, the IMF agent, and he picks up the money, and then all of a sudden a car drives by, and she tries to, you know, kill him and the contact person to death. She apparently dies, and he gets the paper bag up after picking himself off the ground, and it's filled with just newsprint cut to the size of bills. They didn't pay him off, or paid him off in fake money, and they tried to machine gun him. Okay, so he assumes it must be a double cross. In the 80s version, which I think is the superior scene, he goes back to the hotel room, finding the contact person, who's our IMF agent, with a gun, and explaining that your employer has decided you have gotten entirely too famous, and I am your replacement. Company loyalty isn't what it used to be. The gold watch looks pretty good. And she tries to shoot him and misses, and he almost makes it out the door, and she gets the drop on him. Then they fight, he gets the gun, apparently shoots her dead, and leaves, presumably to go find Scorpio and repay him for trying to kill him. Well, of course, the gun's loaded with blanks, or otherwise, you know, she has some sort of squibs. She's not actually dead. And they come collect her, and then the chase is on. We're going to follow our assassin back to find out who Scorpio is.
In L.A., he grabs a cab, right?
I think he takes a cab over to an address, goes in, and there's this older gentleman there who recognizes him and says, you're not supposed to come here, and they kill each other.
In a gunfight. Blam. And they're both, Scorpio's dead. No, Scorpio was wounded. They were calling an ambulance, remember?
In the original,
Lorca dies. He's killed by Scorpio, but they get Scorpio. They call an ambulance to come for Scorpio.
Okay, they do get him.
In the 80s version, Drake Delancey uses the same hallucinogen on Scorpio that he used on Tom Copperfield. And then Scorpio, in the 80s version, even though he's got the hallucinogen, he's going to die, pulls a gun from his desk like he's going to shoot Drake. Mm-hmm. Click, click. And Drake is like, how stupid do you think I am? Of course, like he unloaded the gun, right? And then this is crazy. Scorpio grabs a letter opener and chucks it 10 feet and stabs Drake in the side with this letter opener he's thrown, right? So Scorpio is a lot more badass in the second version because he almost kills the international assassin with a letter opener.
Well, the thing is also, in the 80s one, Scorpio is, and the characters have the same name, they have the same name who completely escapes me. They mention it. You don't hear it before this point or after this point.
Mm-hmm. It's not relevant to the plot, so it doesn't really.
But he's actually appeared earlier in the 80s.
In the 80s version, he was also at the party and talking to Mr. Copperfield, Jim's protege, who was then killed by John Delancey's character. So you've seen this actor before right at the beginning. He was apparently a good friend of Copperfield, but apparently realized Copperfield was getting close to unmasking his Scorpio, and so he had him killed. So in this one, after you see the assassin go down, you cut to police and sirens and such, and apparently you hear from the bystanders that, this guy jumped out of the window. Somebody did that 2 weeks ago here. And the assassin is not dead. He's just badly wounded, has an oxygen mask on, is semi-conscious in the back of the ambulance.
And then you get that great scene where Jim walks up and Nicholas walks up and Max walks up and Grant walks up and Casey walks up. And then suddenly it's that moment where the villain realizes he's been in the web the whole time. What is real? What is not real? What's been happening to me? And he sees these faces he's seen over the last couple of days in these different contexts. And they let him know that, wah, wah, we've got you. We've always had you. You were doomed when this started. And they don't always do this. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they just get in the van and drive away. And sometimes Jim steps up and lets you know, we got you.
Mm-hmm. And in this case, since it was Jim's protege that got killed.
Yeah, it's personal.
There's a great scene because after Drake checks into the hotel, Jim is, in both cases, is running the front desk. He's, the hotel manager and checks him in and such. And, just perfectly, wishes him a good day or whatever. And as soon as the assassin goes up the stairs in the 80s one, you just see his face completely change. And just, goes into the secret back room and Nicholas wants to know, is he okay? It's like, I want to just reach across the desk and strangle him. I'm not sure I can still do this anymore.
Yeah. It's a moment where, number one, you get an insight into Peter Graves, I think, because Graves is a really good actor. And the way he plays the cool, calculating, logical Jim Phelps, playing somebody else through so much of the run of Mission Impossible. It's one of those things where he's not doing Waiting for Godot to name check that again. He's not doing 12 Angry Men. He's not necessarily doing whatever. But the skill of him as an actor, I do think, gets undersold sometimes. And then you get an insight into the character of Jim Phelps, which I think is also great. Mm-hmm. And to wit, Jim spends most of his life coolly and calculating and logically taking down villains of all stripes. God help you if Jim Phelps is pissed at you. God help you if Jim Phelps is actually mad at you. Because it's over. He will track your ass to the end of the earth. There's nothing you can do.
It was a neat load of acting. He sold a lot of it with just the body language. You don't even see his face, just the way the way his shoulders slump when he comes in there. But I thought that was, I thought it was just kind of
neat. And just that look of hatred when the guy can't see him.
It was really good. So
And Peter Graves was good at what he did. Mm-hmm. God rest your soul, Mr. Graves. We love you over here.
But the thing, I kind of like, this was kind of in, the tail end. We had like a couple of different, we had like some various things, like the Wild Wild West, not reboot, but basically reunion movies. We had, Uncle reunion.
But by the time we got to the 88 Mission Impossible, there had already been the Uncle reunion movie.
Yep.
Robert Conrad and Ross Martin did a couple of Wild Wild West movies in the 80s. Mm-hmm. There had been the Uncle the reunion. There's the Mission Impossible reunion. There was the
Star Trek The Next Generation started
Star Trek
the
Next
before.
Generation. There was the new Avengers in the 70s, which didn't take off the way the original Avengers did. I don't think Magoo ever came back, did he? Magoo never came back for anything
Spider-related. Oh, no.
Although there was an attempt at a new version of the Saint in the 70s, too. Oh.
I thought you said I thought you were talking about Mr. Magoo.
No, Patrick Magoo. Susan used to call him Magoo.
Ah.
So that still sticks. For all that, though, we hadn't recycled quite everything yet in 1988.
No, but the thing for me was just the idea of getting the old spy back in the saddle. Same reason, the one thing I loved about Spy Game and with Robert Redford.
That was good.
Because, I'd seen Sneaker, you had Sneakers about, Sneakers 15
was
or 20 years ago.
Sneakers was fall of 92. We're looking at 26 years for Sneakers
26,
now.
Yeah. So you had that, and you had Captain America 2, were both really cool little movies where Robert Redford putting on the spy movie... in a spy movie, it's like watching somebody put on a glove that just fits them perfectly. It's like Clint Eastwood in Westerns.
It's the old master coming out of retirement to show the young whippersnappers how it's done.
There's just something kind of cool about that. Yeah. And again, Spy Game, at some point we need to do Spy Game. Spy Game's great movie.
But you're right, there's that shot at the cemetery in the 80s version where the camera moves away from the actual funeral proper and you see this guy lurking behind a tombstone, a gravestone, and it's Phelps and he's wearing a trench coat. He's wearing a trench coat. He's looking behind the gravestone. This figure of death and shadows lurking over there. And it's almost, it's just perfect.
Well, also,
it's perfect.
They play a very somber, very slow tempo arrangement of the theme music that just absolutely, it just completely changes the entire impact. Mm. And it's just, here's 20, 30 years of regret. Just,
all the memories, all there's memory, there's a sense of loss. Mm. Where has he been? What has he been doing? He's lost a friend.
Yeah.
It's great.
I mean, Mission Impossible, normally, the TV show didn't really get into the corrosive aspects of, intelligence work and the toll it takes on people.
Yeah.
Most of the Bonds didn't. I think some of the
some of the Craig gets into it a little bit.
And I think you get a little bit, GoldenEye, and then
in the Brosnan films, you get a little bit of a hint of it.
Yeah,
and GoldenEye in particular, where he's speaking with the service psychologist, and then you get, because of the extremes of what he goes through in Die Another Day, you get some hint of that Bond is paying a price for what he's doing in that.
Right, and definitely the Craig,
the subtext of the Craig gear is all about the price it costs.
But those are much later. You don't really see that outside of Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, outside of your John le Carré stuff,
going back to Connery, happy birthday, Sir Sean. Connery is like, he loves the shooting and the death and the sex and the drinking. You never get the hint that Connery pays a cost of anything. Connery's Bond is like, every once in a while he gets worried, like, I don't want to die. I don't want to be sliced in half by a laser beam, but you never get the sense that Connery pays a price for anything. Roger, as much as I love Roger, you certainly never get a sense that Roger pays a cost. Solo and Kuryakin, you never get a sense that Solo and Kuryakin pay a cost.
I beg to differ.
Okay.
Where Roger is leaving flowers at Tracy's grave.
Is that strictly speaking the ongoing cost of being an intelligence operative, or is that just I lost my wife?
He lost his wife because he was an intelligence operative. She was killed by the very people he was trying to destroy. If he had been a charter accountant, it wouldn't have even been an issue.
Okay, fair point.
But for the most part,
he presumably wouldn't have married the daughter of the head of the Corsican mafia either.
Right. Yeah. For the most part, Roger stuff is fairly fairly lighthearted, and he's good at killing. He doesn't necessarily enjoy it, but he's reasonably good at his job, as he said.
Now, I don't think it's a coincidence that's probably the best Roger's best movie too.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah,
that's not. I don't think that's a coincidence that the one time we do address that, that's also the best of Roger's Bonds.
Yeah. No, that's. And again, I think that one, the way all of that works, it all connects back to the themes of these are the prices people pay for this. So I think that one, Roger does. But for the most part, that's been something absent from Mission Impossible up until maybe the movies. And, I'll take that back. The 80s show does start, you know, touch on that. There's some other ones in the second season.
We should say here, that this is not the episode we originally were going to cover.
Yeah,
this.
Touching on that. There's a second season one that we were originally going to do. Hey, let's do 80s Mission Impossible. Hey, here's this one. We'll do
Here's an interesting one where they actually lose a team member, and we can watch a story where the tape scene always says, if any of your team are ever lost or killed, they'll be disavowed by the secretary, right? So we'll do the episode where that happens. It's like something that taps into the lore and the mythology. And we watched that episode, and lo and behold, we were all ready to tap a vein by the time that was over.
It's a surprisingly disturbing episode on a number of levels.
It's dark, and it's grim, and it's just psychologically really disturbing.
So we're going to come back to that one a lot later.
You know what? Maybe not ever. We don't ever really have to come back to that
one. A lot later. There were a lot of episodes of Mission Impossible.
There's lots of episodes of Man from U.N.C.L.E. and The Avengers and The Prisoner and Wild Wild West and Mission Impossible. Now, I'm probably not, I don't think we're ever going to do I Spy, because I don't need to watch Bill, that the rapist was... Huxtable Cosby.
Apparently, that's a really great 60s spy show, too.
No, it's great. It's supposed to be spectacular.
Okay, so if it is spectacular, we'll just put that way on the other side of what we're ever going to watch. We got to watch Spy Game, and then we got to do the two episodes of Star Trek that are overtly spy tribute shows.
We got to do Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy.
Really?
We do.
That's the old one or the new one?
Because he doesn't like the new one.
The new one was just, I thought, boring.
And it's not like in the style of spy movie that we normally cover.
That's fair.
Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy is kind of outside our remit. That's the more Le Carre kind of stuff
that we don't
usually cover.
The thing is, I like the Le Carre elements. I like the little bit of that, you know, where the two overlap. Spy Game very much has a lot of those Le Carre elements in that. Mm-hmm. And very much
But Spy Game was a good movie.
Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy is a
really
good movie.
I really liked the Gary Oldman version of Tinker
Tailor.
Well, but you see, I was heartbroken by it because I love everybody in it and I love the idea of it, but I'm just like,
That Forest of Mirrors vibe is exactly the stuff Atomic Blonde, which we need to do a full review. I think it's out on Blu-ray.
They're doing another one of those.
Nope. Excellent.
I've heard they're doing another one.
But that's very much the same kind of Forest of Mirrors. You can't entirely trust who you're working for, or even the person telling you the story.
And that's great, but why does it have to be boring?
I didn't find it boring.
I thought the second one was boring.
Okay.
I like the kind of thing where it's slow burn and suspenseful. It doesn't always have to be cars exploding after being shot by laser beams. But I just thought that specific one was maybe not what it could have been.
No, that's fair. That's fair. But that's, I mean, there's a whole bunch of spy movies we could get to before we get to that one or I Spy.
Okay. So have we covered this one? Have we said all we need to say about this one?
I think so. I mean, I think the 80s one is probably of the two the superior one.
Yeah, I might agree.
Okay, I mean,
I might agree, actually.
Everybody has something to do.
It doesn't have the really strong cast from the 60s series.
Right. Again, it's a season 5 60s one, so that those are not strong scripts in the batch there. I'm not a huge fan of give our protagonist a personal reason. You've heard us rant about Spectre. And yes, I was the author of all your misery, Mr. Bond. Your parking space on Tuesday I took. You don't need that level.
I was the one that gave you the spoiled mayonnaise on that tuna salad you ordered from the commissary last week.
Right, so you don't need that level of that. But, you know, this one, it's a nice little, I'm coming
back. I seeded your shower with toe fungus.
Anyway,
you know, it does have that nice little, Jim's coming back for one last mission.
I hacked your Netflix, Mr. Bond.
It's personal, and I kind of like that. It does give some invested stakes. Peter Graves is really good in this one.
I bought your favorite radio station, and they only play Smash Mouth now, Mr. Bond, because of me.
But the cast has more to do. It's cut somewhat faster, so you aren't having to, you don't have to flip on the, okay, this is 60s TV, it's going to be a little slower, and there's 5 minutes fewer of commercials, but it's a little slower, so maybe on balance it's a wash. You don't have to use that part of your brain.
Maybe I'm more used to the 60s shows since we've been watching them, but this is of another era actually hit me more strongly with the 80s remake than with the 60s show.
I think possibly because we were in that era. That was the thing. This was 87,
right? So the 60s for us, the 60s were never real for us.
Right, right. They always looked like that.
Right. So right. We feel the distance from the 80s episode. Mm-hmm. We feel that period better because we were alive for that. We
saw this in first run. Mm-hmm. I remember this. When we first got our little, hey, they've got the 80s Mission Impossible DVD on Amazon. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, click. Okay, because we didn't really have plans to do an episode or anything. I'm like, it's the 80s Mission Impossible. I love this. I'd never seen the Mission Impossible. And again, part of it, my dad had seen the original Mission Impossible, and he liked that one, as I recall. And again, there's you know, same thing like with Looney Tunes or whatever. You know, your stuff you watch with your relatives and such when you're a little kid, it's like, it's special. You know, if there's a TV show that your dad was real fond of, you have fond memories of that TV show because you watch it with him. Same thing there. So I remember watching this when it was on the first time, so it's a little weird. Yeah, I can see where... Mm-hmm. It's, oh, wow, that was 80, you know, that was a long time ago. Computers were very, very different, and oh, my goodness.
And you see, that's one of the reasons to watch this.
Everything has a 4:3 aspect ratio.
Yeah.
And we watched this with Eric's daughter, so we got the modern kid
version of it, and she seemed to enjoy both of them just fine. Then again, me and her mother are the ones that have raised her, so she's not necessarily going to have the point of view of just Jolene average off the street.
Yeah, I don't think she would necessarily go crazy with, you know, one of those videos where they're like, we're going to show kids these days a rotary phone. Or...
Yeah, so she's not average, but she liked them both. Now, I'm not one of those people that harps about how I think it's okay to remake things. I think it's okay to retell stories. There are stories we retell because they're the good stories. There's always room for originality. There's always room for new work that speaks to its time and to its place. But I think it's important to sometimes redo things. We tell the good stories over and over again because they're the good stories. I guess to take a slightly longer view of it, I mean, we tell these stories because they reinforce the values that we hold dear. And however Ray and I over there disagree about the characters and the eras and their motivations and where they get their paychecks and whatnot, we are also stuck with the idea that these people put their lives on the line, that they risk themselves for the greater good. So if we're going to look at the morals and messages of Mission Impossible, and we've touched on this before, we've got people who risk their lives for the greater good. We have the idea that working as a unit, you get more done than just working on your own. That there are morals and messages and ideas reinforced by this particular idea that I think are good to pass on. And I think they're the reasons why you go from Dan Briggs in episode one in 1966, and you go to what we just saw with Tom Cruise and the whole big Fallout bonanza, which was spectacular. And there are ideas at the core of those. There are morals and things that mean things in the core of these that are worth passing on. But, and then again, there's also cool spy shows and rubber masks. Well, so I don't want to get too, like, lit professor about it, but well, there you go.
We also lucked out that they said, okay, here's a classic show. We're going to pull, we already own the scripts. We don't have to pay the writers a dime. Wahaha.
So in a way,
they picked a good one rather than like remaking a 60s sitcom.
Yeah.
In a sense, we lucked out.
We did luck out. Now, here's the thing. The fact that this 80s version exists at all is really kind of a craven stab at the writer's strike back in 88. But I can't help all that. That was all 30 years ago. That's all over and done, and we're left with the show. The show's pretty good. So there we are. Do I approve of the fact that they did this to shaft the writers? No, and I will make a small offering to the Dread Lord Ellison for that later. But we're also stuck with the fact that this is a pretty good show. The actors are good, and the show looks good, and maybe we'll look at some more of these 80s versions and see what became of it. Okay, cool. Thank you for listening to the Agents of Cool tonight. My Twitter handle is grumpy6. My email here at the show is number6, all lowercase, number6@agentsof.cool. Ray?
Ray@agentsof.cool.
Stacy?
Mrs. Peel, MRSPEEL, no period, @agentsof.cool.
Thank you, as always, for listening to us. Please tweet at me or email us if there's a comment you have to make, if there's a question, if there's a topic you'd like us to cover for the show, if you have a good recipe for cobbler. We're open to whatever it is you feel like you need to say to us. Please tune in next time. We're going to keep bringing these shows to you. Thank you very much for listening.
Okay, what do we got here listed here?
It's up there. Well, I want to talk about the Danny Boyle thing.
Oh, right. He's leaving.
Dump book?
No. Nobody can read my handwriting. Emperor? Give me that. You can't read my handwriting anyway. Give
Body
me that.
Double? I can't read your handwriting.
You can't read my handwriting. Empire. Well, Danny Boyle. We need to talk about. You're looking at my show notes.
It says dump book.
No, it doesn't. It says Danny Boyle, but I wrote it with a Sharpie, and nobody can read my handwriting anyway. Nobody can read my handwriting anyway. Okay, Danny Boyle quit Bond 25 this week over creative differences.